The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the weekend, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. This is episode 278 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This week's guest is a very special guest. His name is Malcolm Linton. He's originally from the UK. He's a photographer, has been a longtime journalist, and also a conflict photographer. And that will be the subject of our discussions in segment three after Adrian Alsema's updates on the news. We'll be talking about Malcolm's new book, Metamorphosis, and it's a book about, well, photographs of the FARC pre and during and post the peace accords. And so he'll be telling us a little bit about this book. The launch has been this week, and well, it's published, it's out there by Villegas Editores, so you'll be able to see it in all good bookstores in Colombia. So very interesting conversation with him. Of course, we stumble from one element to another in the political spectrum here in Colombia, but on Saturday, Colombia defeated Argentina in the Copa America in their opening game, 2-0. And of course, this is pan y circo, as they say here. Pan y circo, well, it's the opioid for the people, the opiate of the people, football. So we'll forget about politics for a little bit, and people will be focusing mainly on Colombia's chances to win the Copa America. But I will not bore you any further. I will leave you in the capable hands of Adrian Alsema for the news update, and then we'll be back in segment three with Malcolm Linton talking about his adventures with the FARC guerrillas in Colombia, photographing them, spending time with them, and how, of course, he got in touch with them. So don't go away. Keep on listening, and thank you, all of you who've responded to episode 277 about Daniel Eggington and his proposed crossing of the Darien Gap. Yes, I get the feeling that a lot of you out there are incredibly concerned about his endeavor, and we have conveyed this to him, of course, so we'll see what comes of that. Anyway, I'll switch off now, and I'll be right back in segment three. Thank you for listening. Please don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Colombia Calling for June 18, 2019. Colombia's former president Álvaro Uribe said Friday he wants to do away with the rule of law in Colombia, replacing it with what he calls the rule of opinion. The rule of opinion would allow the public to overrule court decisions through referendums. According to Uribe, the country's judicial branch has done enormous damage to me and to many citizens who disagree with decisions of the court. The Supreme Court is investigating the former president after decades of claims he was an associate of the Medellin cartel and formed his own death squad. Supporters of Uribe announced on Thursday that they would seek to abolish the country's war crimes tribunal and revoke the country's high courts. Herbin Hoyos, a far-right activist and conspiracy theorist, said that his Liberty and Order movement would seek to do this through a referendum. The initiative, which received the blessing of Uribe, will need 1.8 million signatures for authorities to begin the proceedings that would allow a referendum. Colombia's national football team defeated Argentina with 2-0 in their first match of the Copa America. The impressive feat is the first tournament victory of Portuguese coach Carlos Queiroz. According to team captain James Rodriguez, we have made history by defeating football giant Argentina for the first time in 12 years. Convicted former army commanders have testified that former National Army Chief General Mario Montoya ordered his subordinates to deliver buckets of blood. One colonel told the War Crimes Tribunal that Montoya personally suggested to kill civilians and present them as guerrillas killed in combat in order to inflate the military's results. The retired general's defense attorney denied the claims despite his defendant's vow to tell the truth to avoid a 40-year prison sentence. Colombia's controversial defense minister survived a motion of no confidence in Congress. The opposition motion against Minister Guillermo Botero was opposed by 121 representatives and supported by 20. The minister has been under fire because of a controversial army order to double the number of combat kills and captures, attempts to cover up the murder of a FARC member, and the fact that Botero has a private security company that is overseen by the ministry he runs. FARC leader Jesus Santrich took seat in Congress on Wednesday amid fierce protests, mainly by Colombia's far-right ruling party. The FARC's faction chief in the House of Representatives was supposed to enter Congress in July last year already, but was in jail at the time over a so far unsubstantiated drug trafficking claim made by the U.S. government. One of the lawmakers who did welcome Santrich was Representative John Jairo Hoyos, whose father was murdered by the FARC in 2007. Hoyos argued that the country needs an enormous reconciliation process because the wounds of war are dramatic and deep. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
Back. This is episode 278 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, and our very special guest this week, as I mentioned earlier in the opening segment of the show, is Malcolm Linton. He's a professional photographer originally from the UK. He's worked on various projects. There's been a book about cases of HIV and AIDS in Tijuana, amongst other things, but most recently, and out this week with Villegas Editores, is his book Metamorphosis, Guerrilleros en Busca de la Paz. Of course, it's a photography book. And Malcolm was down in the guerrilla encampments before the bilateral ceasefire had been agreed and before the peace accords were signed off on, and then afterwards. So he was there photographing this transition from, let's say, the ending of a belligerent status into that of, you know, reincorporation and reintegration for the FARC guerrillas. And so, well, thank you for being on Colombia Calling, Malcolm.
Well, it's great to be with you, Richard.
It's a real pleasure to have you here because you have come with a different perspective to Colombia because, of course, you worked here back in the 80s, I want to say.
Yeah, I was here as a reporter from 85 to 86. That was at the time of the attack on the Palace of Justice by M19, and a week later, the Armero disaster, where there was a volcano eruption, and I think around a huge number of people were killed, 23,000 or something like that. So those were the big news stories when I was here in the 80s. I actually came to Colombia at first in 76.
Wow.
And kind of fell in love with the place and wanted to come back eventually, and 9 years later I made it.
Sounds about right. You were here, so in the year of my birth, 1976, it's a fair few years ago now, 42, almost 43. So you bring with it, let's say, this wealth of knowledge from the country, which I think I've seen the proofs of the book and so on, and the photography. There, you come to it with a greater profundity. So let's say it's someone that drops in like a fireman to take photos quickly and then come out again. I think you've got, there's a more sensibility behind the lens, I think, for this. So anyway, I recommend this book immensely, Metamorphoses, Guerrilleros en Busca de la Paz. So, but let's talk a little bit about this, because I know what my listeners really enjoy hearing, and it's how you set up meetings with the FARC, and we're talking pre-Zonas de Transición, when there was a bit more access and it was a bit more open. We're talking about getting out there into the jungle when the government hasn't signed a bilateral ceasefire, but the FARC have signed their own, well, they've declared their own unilateral ceasefire. Of course, it's, you know, the big difference between one side and the other. How is it that you end up getting out there and getting into these places? I mean, do you take a bus to a far-off town and sit and wait for a contact? Tell us.
Well, it's actually always a lot easier than people would think. You just have to think about it in a kind of methodical way. When I started on this story, which was just at the beginning of 2016, I started by looking around in Bogota to see who might be able to connect me to the FARC leadership, who would give me permission to do the story. And there were all sorts of people who said they had this connection or that connection, and said they would help and so on. And perhaps they did and perhaps they didn't. I don't know. But the fact was that nothing was happening after a few months. The peace talks were going on in Havana. So the most obvious route to get to the leadership was simply to go to Havana. Huh. I didn't have a press card or any credentials from the Cubans. So I went to Havana. I went to the hotel where the peace talks were going on. I sat in the coffee bar, and whenever any of the FARC delegates came out, I buttonholed them and sat them down and talked to them and showed them my previous book. When I was here in 85, 86, I did go and visit the FARC at Casa Verde. So I knew Manuel Marulanda and Jacobo Arenas and Alfonso Cano from that time.
Wow.
And that gave me some kind of extra credibility. Mm. Anyway, so that process of sitting around drinking a lot of coffee in Havana went on for, I suppose, 5 or 6 days. And after that, I thought I'd talk to everybody I probably could talk to. And I came back to Bogota and wondered what would happen. And sure enough, a few weeks later, I get a message from a guy by the name of Julian Subverso, to say that my application to go to a camp has been approved, and I should be ready to go. I waited again a few more weeks, and eventually the instruction came through. I traveled down with an English filmmaker, documentary maker, Emily Wright. We went together. Mm-hmm. We went to a small village, took a bus down to, what's the place called? San Vicente.
Ah, in Calamansi.
And then got a jeep into the middle of the jungle. We were met by a FARC guy. There were soldiers there.
Yeah.
We were the only two white people in the village, the only two foreigners. Yeah. So it was quite clear that we were up to no good. But the soldiers decided not to arrest us, I guess. And the contact took us off to meet the leaders. That was El Médico Mauricio.
Yeah.
We talked to the leaders, and they seemed to like the project, and the next day they took us to a camp, and we stayed there 3 weeks.
This is contradictions that I think that, you know, Colombia just has in its dozens, droves, whatever, scores. You can go down. I mean, San Vicente de Caguan essentially was once when I landed there, and I've been a couple of times. I landed there for a flight, then on to Caquetá, down to Araraquara. so further in into Tranquilandia. And I talked to a soldier at the base. I said, you know, what have you got here in San Vicente? And he went, soldiers and whores. That's what he said. And so, you know, you're either in an NGO, I guess, if you're down there, if you're a European looking person, or you're on some sort of investigation. So people have to know. There are no secrets. And then you drive in a jeep out to the middle of the jungle where you say there are soldiers around, but they don't arrest you and you continue on in. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Well, I suppose the soldiers aren't really interested in making their lives difficult. Mm. So they don't want to ask you questions that would result in having to arrest you, and then, you know, there would be a reaction, no doubt. If I'd been arrested, I would have caused trouble. And so it was much better really just to let it go. Mm. I suspect that the soldiers and the guerrillas out in the far-flung parts of the country have some sort of live and let live policy a lot of the time. They are, after all, the same people.
Yeah.
They come from the same families. Mm. So I suppose they just wanted to have a quiet life and therefore didn't want to cause any problems.
I can understand that. That makes a lot of sense to me, that it's this sort of coexistence in these areas. And of course, I've seen that in places like San Juan de Losada, when you go in from on that border between Meta and Caquetá, and you can see it. There's a sort of, let's say, a fluidity between the two entities, let's say, I think. But let's move back a little bit to your book then, and you've taken this photograph. Well, actually, before I get there, it's like you spent a great deal of money getting this all put together, several weeks waiting in Bogota, then you fly out to Havana, and I guess you're spending your mornings or days in the Havana Libre. Is that where they were doing the hotel where they were doing the
I didn't stay in a hotel.
You stayed in Havana. But you drank a lot of coffee. Well, that's not so expensive. But this is an expensive enterprise, though. You know, flights and so on, and then photography is no longer cheap.
This has been a colossally expensive enterprise from beginning to end.
There you say, buy the book.
No, even if you do buy the book, I won't make a whole lot of money out of that because of the way the percentages work.
Okay.
But the way these things work is I decided I would do this project. I had been living in New York. I'd had an apartment in New York. I decided I was through with living in the States. Mm-hmm. I sold the apartment, so I had some money. Mm. I started on this project. I assumed that I would be able to use that money as kind of seed money to get the project going. That once I could show some decent images and once I had a clear idea of what exactly the project was, I could get people to invest in it. Mm. That, as it turned out, was hopelessly optimistic. Apparently, the project was far too politically sensitive for anybody to want to invest in it. And the only money I got to support the project was a little grant from UNDP to mount part of the first exhibition. Uh-huh. So there's been no money from then on. Mm. But the thing is, you get interested in this kind of project. Yeah. You become obsessed with it. Yeah. You tell people that you're going to produce a book.
Yeah.
And then suddenly to decide that you're going to abandon the project and you're not going to produce a book, it was something that I just didn't want to do. So I went on supporting the project myself, and eventually now I've produced the book. And I'm tremendously pleased about that, and it's very satisfying. But it has caused colossal financial damage.
Yeah. But I think behind it, there is a greater ulterior motive to you
putting this book out. I mean, you want people to see these photos. You haven't deliberately taken photos of victims of the conflict. We're not looking at something like Jesus Abad, Colorado, and you're not focusing on the drugs side of things or the kidnapping side of things. This is basically, and I would say more on the rank and file of the FARC, what I want to say is a sort of forlorn hope of their outfit.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think the work of people like Jesus Abad and Juan Manuel Echevarria and other people who photograph victims is absolutely essential in Colombia right now. I think it's very important that those sorts of things are documented. But when I started in the project in 2016, already there was so much of that kind of work around that I didn't see that I had to add to it, and I thought I would do something different. Mm. I've always been interested in groups that have been rejected by the greater society. I'm interested in showing who those groups of people are, and I'm interested in exploding the myths that that inevitably and always exist about them. So that was my idea with the FARC. I wasn't interested in doing some kind of propaganda effort for them. I was interested in just trying to get to the truth of who most of the individual rank and file guerrillas were. I wasn't even interested in particularly in the leaders. I wasn't particularly interested in the politics. Although it's a highly political story, in a sense, it's focused on the human end of the political situation.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a few photos that obviously have stood out for me looking at them, but the one most is, I think it's the guy brushing his teeth.
He's brushing his teeth.
And yet you sort of see him doing this mundane, everyday act, and then notice he's missing his arm.
You know,
so how do they receive you? I guess if the upper echelons of the FARC have said, listen, this guy is underneath our auspices, he's our guest in the camps, the rest of the rank and file toe the line, and you have access.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way it works. I suppose with the leaders, there was a calculation going on about whether this kind of story was ultimately going to be good for them or be bad for them. I suppose they decided that on balance it would be good for them. They, having said that, they didn't put any limitations on me at all.
Wow.
They said I could photograph whatever I wanted to, I could talk to whoever I wanted to talk to, that was actually the case. There were no limitations put on me retrospectively. The rank and file fighters were perfectly happy to go along with that.
Right.
They were interested in the project. They actually surprised me because I've worked with lots of guerrilla groups in the past. And with, you know, leftist groups, you tend to get a big spiel of kind of fairly adolescent type left-wing ideology thrown at you, and a very rigid political line. These people were very different. They didn't mostly talk in rigid ideological terms. They were interested in other points of view. Their politics essentially were focused on a more egalitarian society, something like that. Again, it was the openness and the readiness to talk and the readiness to think about other points of view that really impressed me. And they were very good to me too. They treated me very well. They were welcoming. They were polite. You know, when it rained and there was water pouring through the plastic sheet above where I was sleeping, within minutes there was somebody there climbing up on top, getting soaked, repairing it.
Wow.
They fed us. Usually they fed me far more food than I could possibly eat. And wondered why I wasn't eating as much as they all were. It was a very good reception that they gave, and it was not a kind of PR reception either. I mean, I stayed 3 weeks the first time with them, and had there been cracks to appear, they would have appeared during that time.
3 weeks is a significant period of time, and most people, you know, who I have had the you know, good fortune of meeting, who've been down into these camps and so on, never have spent 3 weeks. I mean, you become part of the family almost.
To a degree, yes. I mean, the point is that I'm always very slow taking pictures because I tend not to take pictures for the first few days, and this is what I did on this trip, because the idea is that I don't want people to be responding to the camera. I want them to be forgetting that I'm there, and therefore if they know who I am, if I've exchanged a few words with them or sat around for an evening with them in many cases, I just become part of the furniture. And although, of course, they can see that I'm taking pictures, they don't really notice and they don't really take it in. So that was one reason why the trip lasted a long time. The other was that I wanted to get to know everybody's name. Yes. I wanted to be able to talk to everybody and have a sense of who they were. Also... Every day there were photographs to take. There were interesting things happening, and while that was going on, why should I cut it short?
Yeah, fascinating. And on the way out of the camps, then, and we were talking about this fluidity between the countryside, the army, and the far. You weren't questioned. You weren't sort of taken into. The back room of the police station and beaten up and asked to give information about the location of the camps and so on?
No, nothing like that. I mean, I'm sure that they knew where all the camps were anyway. I'm sure that they all knew exactly what I was doing. And I had answers ready to give them so that they would have something to write in their books if they needed to put down an explanation for why I was there. I think I said I was doing some sort of research project or whatever. A friend told me I should say I was photographing exotic birds.
That's what I was going to ask. You say you're a bird watcher. and then Fontour and Pro Columbia will back you up. But I mean, you know, it's really interesting. It just exists, and I've long believed this about the situation in Colombia. It's just here, isn't it? It's just this. But so you've talked about the sleeping and the eating, but you weren't exposed to any long marches or anything like that.
No, not at all.
Because they weren't marching at this point.
No, they weren't marching. I mean. No, we did. We walked around a bit. You know, we went out to places where they were repairing roads and that kind of thing. We moved from one camp to another a couple of times. That was at night. It was interesting, actually. The first time we moved from one camp to another, they were using little headlights.
Yes.
That was after the ceasefire had been accepted by the government. And they told me that before the ceasefire, they would never use lights at night. And in fact, in the camps before the ceasefire, in the camp where I was before the ceasefire, we weren't supposed to show any lights at night. And on the paths that threaded their way through the camp, at sort of shoulder level, there were narrow pieces of branches, so that you could run your hand along the along the branch and stay on the path without having to be able to see anything.
It's another existence, isn't it? This darkness. And how many camps did you end up visiting, let's say?
I have to add it up. But okay. I think that during that first three-week period, there were three camps.
Yeah.
I went back to one of them later. Then I started to go to the different transition zones. I don't know. I suppose if you include the transition zones, it's probably about 10 or something like
that.
It's
a good amount, though. I mean, we're talking about a very broad base of different areas of Colombia, too.
Well, not so much, actually. It was mostly Meta, Guaviare, that sort of area. And in a way, I wasn't really trying to cover all the camps throughout Colombia, or this wasn't in any sense a kind of encyclopedic project. I built a number of relationships with people during the first trip, and I tended to try to follow up with those people, visiting them as they moved to different camps and finally to family homes, and even here moving to Bogota. And, you know, as I stayed with those people, I met people they knew and then got to know them, built relationships with them, and then began to follow them. It was all kind of on that basis of following people.
Okay. Though, I kind of need to ask, I don't want to get you in any trouble or anything like this, but how do you feel about the current situation here in Colombia regarding the outcomes of the... Well, I mean, we're a couple of years on now. Peace was signed in 2016 through all of its different guises. You know, you can be pro the referendum, contra the referendum. Then it was signed into court, into constitution and pushed through. And now we're seeing President Duque bringing up those six issues and the whole issue of impunity, and now this current debate has been around whether Ivan Santri, who has been accepted into his political position. I mean, what do you see this as a photographer who's seen the other side so intimately? How do you see it, and that perhaps the reaction of some of your contacts?
Facts are a hard thing to put your hand on around here, but I can tell you my impressions. My impression at the time of the peace accords was that pretty much all the guerrillas were on board with that. All the FARC were on board with that. And they believed and hoped that this was going to work out. And I admire the way that they've stuck to the agreement, despite the failure to comply with the agreement by the authorities, or to be able to fulfill the agreement, many aspects of the agreement by the authorities. Let's say that.
Yeah.
Of course, some of the FARC have decided that things aren't going to work out, and they've gone back to the jungle and become dissidents, which is, it's a very sad thing in my view, because I think there was a real chance of moving forward and getting out of this process of conflict that Colombia has been in for more than 200 years, way before the FARC ever appeared. And more people will join the dissidents as they find their situation grows worse, which is what appears to be happening at the moment. I talk to people, to ex-FARC people who are still within the peace process, and they say to me that they have no wish to join the dissidents. Mm. But if the choice is between joining the dissidents and being murdered, they will join the dissidents.
Of course.
Also, many of these people were people with quite strong political convictions. And therefore, it's not tempting to join a political movement, to join a subversive movement, an insurgent movement, which is, as far as I can see at the moment, without any particular ideology. Mm-hmm. The dissident groups at this point seem to be focused on their own survival, mm-hmm. And not pushing any kind of social agenda. So essentially, they're outlaws. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons why they're outlaws. I can understand it. But they're quite different from what the old FARC was, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's. Yeah, I think you're probably very, very correct on that one. And as we wind this down, I mean, I will have to ask: is why Metamorphosis as a title?
Well, one thing was that the project had a different name. It was called initially When the Ink Dries. And that was about when the ink dried on the treaty and what would happen after the treaty. That was sort of a working title, and I was never particularly happy with it. One night about 6 months ago, Metamorphosis just appeared in my head and seemed like the right title, and I began to think about why. Mm. One reason is that Metamorphosis in English and Metamorphosis in Spanish is essentially the same word, and given that it's a bilingual book, that was important. The other thing is that, of course, if anybody mentions Metamorphosis, the first thing that many people think of is the story by Franz Kafka.
Yes.
By having that reference, in a way, I'm saying, look, this is not just a collection of my favorite, tourist pictures of the FARC. It's a piece that has a structure and has an idea behind it, and I want it to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. Clearly, Metamorphosis is about. It describes a process of change, and that's the change that many of the guerrillas went through, from being fighters to being civilians. Mm-hmm. And then there's another aspect of the process as well, which is that I hope that in looking at the book, people may change their attitudes about who and what. These fighters were. They've been characterized by much of the media here for decades as monsters, and that's part of the standard dehumanization that one side applies to another during any conflict. I'm hoping that there will be a kind of metamorphosis. In the way that people think about this period of Colombian history and these people who were involved in it.
Mm. Well, yeah, I think that's right, and I hope that we can have publications out there which sort of stimulate at least debate, constructive debate. You know, it's difficult to have a standpoint, obviously, as foreigners, because we still, even resident here, look at it through a different lens. That's the truth, I think. But fantastic that you should be doing this. Fantastic that the book has been picked up and distributed by Villegas, big publishing company here in Colombia, and that will surely give it some longevity, definitely on the shelves. So let's, as we, you know, we have to finish now, unfortunately. Where can people get the book?
The main bookshops in Colombia, yeah. Especially in Bogota. You can also go to the Villegas site, www.villegaseditores.com. Mm-hmm. Those would be the places to look.
And for people overseas, will be on Amazon at some point? Or
It will be on Amazon at some point. It's a question of how to get it to the States.
Yeah.
Amazon is not as simple as it appears to be, but I will make sure that I get it on Amazon eventually.
Excellent. Excellent. So do check that out. It's it's come out this week, and it's on VillegasEditores.com. The name of the book is Metamorphosis, Guerrilleros en Busca de la Paz. I've been talking to the photographer, you know, and of course the guy behind the book, Malcolm Linton, and that's been a fantastic conversation about a side that we don't often see, read about, hear about. And well, I wish you all the best with this book and the reception. I hope you get the kind of reception that it merits.
Well, I'm sure that people will accuse me of being paid by the FARC, but there you go.
We live in a polarized world, and there's no way of escaping this right now, regardless of what you try and say or do. So, well, thank you for being on Columbia Calling and sharing your thoughts and anecdotes with us, and I know that my listeners will have enjoyed this immensely.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
You're most welcome. So that's been episode 278 of the Columbia Calling podcast for this week. We'll be back next week with further interesting people talking about something to do with Colombia. Of course, get in touch at columbiacalling.com, at Twitter, and our website. I mean, our email is columbiacalling@gmail.com. Of course, we're on Facebook too. We'll post links to the book and to Malcolm's website on the Facebook site. And of course, buy it. Help out a photographer, and we all need the help. So thank you again for listening, and goodbye.